ladies and gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to welcome Professor Angus Johnson back to Cambridge, because we think he's actually one of ours. The fact that he has been teaching in the other place for now quite some time is neither here nor there. Angus is Professor of Law and Fellow in Law at University College, and has a BA, BCL from Oxford, unfortunately, and an LLM from the University of Leiden. He's author of many books and teaches EU law and tort law, and is one of the experts on EU environmental and EU energy law. Today, he's going to talk to us about renewable energy certificates, and is going to share some of his research that has been going on for quite some time. We're going to have about 40 minutes of lecture, and then there will be ample space for questions and comments. Thank you, Angus.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have been invited back. Thank you very much. And it's also nice to come back to somewhere that I feel I owe a great debt to. So I'm able publicly to acknowledge that this place was very, very kind to me and great to me, and still talks to me even though I had the temerity to leave and go somewhere else. So thank you very much. I find myself in a bit of a quandary talking about this kind of topic, because I never really thought I was an environmental lawyer, but it turns out that being an energy lawyer made me one, when suddenly everyone decided that the way to achieve a variety of environmental, important environmental goals was through the energy sector and various aspects of it. And that particularly, I think, become very clear in the fields of emissions trading, emissions control, and also in the field of trying to promote renewable energy. This is, for some countries, obvious, and for other countries, a very controversial idea, simply because there's a variety of different natural resources that different countries actually have in the field of renewable energy. On a day like today, you can think that the British pursuing solar energy might be a bit of a challenging thing to do, for example, although technology is improving, and maybe it makes sense in a lot of ways here too. But this topic all stems from a question I was once asked by a bunch of Cambridge economists. They said, we've read this directive in 2009, and it says that there are binding renewables targets for member states to achieve under EU law, and you're the lawyer. Come and talk to us and tell us what binding means. And I said, well, okay, I can do that. So I read the directive and I thought very hard about it. And this is not a philosophical question for me. I'm very much a pragmatic, sort of empirical type person. I'm not going to give you some discourse on obligations to obey the law and all the rest of it. That's not really the point. Rather, the question is, the EU says that there are binding targets for renewables at EU level, and that member states also have binding targets under the umbrella of the EU target. How binding are they? How can you actually sensibly enforce them? What sort of teeth do they really have? And why should we care about that? So just as a brief outline, that's what I propose to try to talk through. Apologies that the handout missed out the fourth section. You'll find that the text of the handout does cover the fourth section. I just forgot to put it on the table of contents at the beginning. So let's start with an introductory question. Which, before we even get on to the debate about whether targets should be binding and how that evolved, why should we even care about this bindingness question? And I think one important reason to care about it is that we start to see, not only in this area but in other areas too, the language of binding targets being used across different areas of EU law. So to have some kind of understanding about what it means to have a target that's set, whether at a European level only, or whether also parceled out to the national level, that is described in some kind of way as formally binding, is something important for us to understand, not just in renewable energy, but you find it also in the area of waste electrical equipment. You find this idea in the context also of certain air traffic management legislation. So you start to see a growth in the use of the idea of what I might loosely describe as target-based governance at the European level, and indeed then the natural sort of journey seems to be targets becoming binding when we care more about actually achieving outcomes as opposed to simply encouraging people to do things. So that's one reason I think why caring about the bindingness of binding targets might be worth pursuing. The other, I think, practically speaking, is to think a little bit about what this idea of target setting is really trying to pursue, and particularly now in the notion of the energy sector in general and renewables in particular. We're living in an age where governments don't have as much disposable money as they used to have, and yet governments still want to achieve various policy goals for often extremely good reasons. So the key question is, who's paying? How are you going to get these sorts of things done if, unlike in the old days, the government simply wasn't going to say, right, we'll build this, we'll organise that, we'll set up this, we'll do that? And the answer, of course, is you have to get someone else to pay for it. You and me, the consumer, is one possible solution. And those of you familiar with the free trade case law will have started thinking about those sorts of questions in judgments like Preussen Elektra for 10 or 15 years ago now. And the other question is, I suppose, trying to encourage investors who have assets to invest those assets in this sort of infrastructure, in these sorts of projects, so that they can then make a return on that and at the same time help us to achieve important public policy environmental goals. And the idea of targets is to encourage member states to put in place regimes that are favourable to those sorts of investments. And the idea of binding targets is to try to give, a stronger steer and encouragement to those people with assets to invest them in this type of activity so that they will make a return, secure in the knowledge that there will be a relatively stable, predictable environment within which they can invest, and at the same time achieving these goals. So there are lots of reasons why we might care very strongly about the bindingness of targets. So let's ask ourselves a few questions about how we got to the point of the EU saying at EU level that there are binding EU and indeed member state targets in renewables. And if you go through the history of this, and the actual paper has a lengthy discussion, but I don't propose to go through it in huge detail here, is this idea that in the wake of the negotiations for the Kyoto Protocol and emissions reduction, one key aspect of that that was perceived by the European level was to try to shift the energy sources that were relied upon to provide the EU's energy needs, and in particular to try to encourage renewables as what were perceived as an indigenous source of energy, and also a source of energy that didn't emit pollutants like carbon and so on. So the idea was mooted in the mid-1990s by the Commission that we should set up some targets to stimulate member state efforts to exploit their renewable energy potentials in general, and in particular their ability to generate electricity from renewable sources. Now, the Commission was clear at this stage that this was not to say that this was going to direct all member states exactly what to do and how to do it, but rather that it should be stimulating and encouraging, leaving member states with flexibility to adopt their own strategies, to take account of their own renewables potentials at national level, national circumstances, trying to work out the national funds that might be available, and to be able to adapt to future developments that might arise in one form or another. Technological might be one, geopolitical might, as we have seen subsequently, be another obvious example. So the starting point of all of this was encouragement, trying to incentivize, but it was not set up in some kind of way to direct what member states should do. Now, with my lawyer's hat on, and I spend a lot of time presenting these sorts of things to people who aren't lawyers, so just a brief moment here, just thinking about this legally. If you have a binding target, most of us as pragmatic lawyers would say binding this is really only going to get anywhere if there's an ability legally to enforce it at the back end, if all other efforts to encourage, incentivize, cajole, etc. were to fail. And so as a lawyer, what one's interested in, I suppose, is what sort of levels, what sort of procedures are there by which these targets, these binding targets, might be enforceable? So at the EU level, the classic place we would look would obviously be the Commission bringing some form of enforcement action against a member state at the EU court level, perhaps indeed pursuing fines, penalties, etc. for failure to achieve these targets. We'll come back to whether that's a good idea in a moment. But I think also crucially, given that a lot of this legislation we're talking about is directives at the European level, the national level in terms of one or other sort of quasi-executive body, independent regulatory bodies, agencies, etc., may have crucial roles to play in setting up, in, for want of a better word, policing the domestic regime that tries to incentivize renewables being developed, exploited, and put onto the grid, but also private parties, in the sense that, first of all, private parties may, in certain limited, perhaps growing ways, be able to pressurize domestic legislators, domestic executives, domestic regulators to do certain things that would encourage this sort of activity, and indeed may also have actions against each other on one ground or another if specific rights can be found in European-level legislation that might then be enforceable at the national level. So we need to bear in mind these two levels and how they might interact in certain ways. So let's start with the first directive on renewables in 2001. And there was a lot of back and forth, a lot of discussion between the Commission and its proposal, member states who liked the idea of doing more about renewables but desperately hated the idea of being told how to do and what to do, and the European Parliament that thought that it would be quite good to have stronger and binding targets but weren't able to get the Council to agree. And what one ends up with in the 2001 directive is what were described as indicative national targets. So the legislation there in 2001 explained, as you see on the screen, that member states were obliged to take appropriate steps. And there were various aspects set up in that legislation trying to ensure that these sorts of things were done and that progress would be made. So they had to publish reports setting out what their national targets would be, what measures they were going to take, what they planned to take, what sort of types of renewable energy might actually be the things they would use to fulfill those goals. Every 2 years they had to report on it and explain whether they succeeded in meeting the targets they'd set for themselves or not, and try to explain why. And the whole regime set up the Commission in a kind of supervisory role to assess what progress they had made towards those national targets, whether the combination of all of those national targets were consistent with the overall EU target under that legislation for renewables. And every 2 years then the Commission would collate all of this information and report. And it was set up to be possible for the Commission to propose that mandatory targets could be adopted at EU-level legislation by the EU legislative organs, the Parliament and the Council. So you see set up here an attempt to give member states quite a lot of free rein, quite a lot of encouragement, but at the same time, if you like, some formal procedural requirements about what member states had to do in terms of reporting, and a measure of detail, but not enormously, about the substance of those plans and those reports and assessments of how they were being pursued. So that's what we started with in the 2001 Renewables Directive. That directive was solely focused on electricity produced from renewable sources. Now, I put this under the same heading because it's more or less in the same phase of the EU's energy and environmental legislation. And that's the directive on biofuels in 2003. And again, you find targets for the minimum proportion of biofuels to be put into the fuel mix, with various reference values as to the energy that could be generated from them. And it also obliged member states to set national, again, indicative targets for biofuels. But there's nothing in either directive that says, and certainly not in the biofuels directive, that says anything about having to achieve these targets, right? So you're set up with a regime here which is trying to incentivize and encourage to cajole member states into doing things and setting down procedural obligations to be achieved in certain ways, but nothing formally about actual target achievement being failed, and then what would you do about it in terms of harder-edged enforcement? There's some enforcement activity with regard to the biofuels directive. There's essentially very little indeed with regard to the first renewables directive. And there, essentially, you can see quite how little a member state has to do before any kind of enforcement can be triggered. So effectively, Italy didn't give any reasons for setting a target that was so low that they blatantly could never get anywhere near achieving the indicative targets they'd set for themselves or contributing to the European-level targets in the legislation. And so that was the Commission publishing its intention to pursue the Italians for basically not having got on with it, and the Italians eventually did get on with it, so there's actually no case, ultimately. Simply the press release there notifying that they couldn't really see Italy given any good reason at all. So that shows you quite how hard it was under that regime for the Commission really to get things done. And easy it was for member states to say a few things, not do very much, and nothing much would necessarily change. So just to give you a bit of a summary, what does this imply? If you set your targets so low, below the reference figures that you would need to achieve anything that you've indicated you might wish to, without an explanation, the Italian type example, fair enough. That could be a ground for enforcement by the Commission. Or if you simply fail to take appropriate steps as the legislation required. It doesn't tell you what appropriate steps are, right, because that's for the member states to choose. But nevertheless, you know, you said no targets at all, we'll just, you know, see how it goes. That would be a problem. Or if you adopt measures which blatantly aren't going to be capable of achieving those targets, then that too could be a ground for the Commission proceeding against the member state. But simply failing to attain the target that was set would not trigger any action by the Commission because the legislation doesn't provide any clear requirement that you do achieve it or any consequences if you don't. So then there follows a rather involved iterative process, as EU legislation, particularly in something as controversial as this, often is, whereby in assessing the impact of the 2001 directive, we had all kinds of problems. We had member states adopting a multiplicity of different ways of reporting what they were doing, how they were doing it, the way they set certain parts of their schemes and their plans, to the point where it was extremely hard to compare what was going on to see what sorts of different approaches were taken. That was one problem. The second problem was it became very clear to the Commission that the member states really weren't doing very much at all, for the most part, honourable exceptions like Germany notwithstanding. And as a result, the likelihood of achieving these targets under the first directive for renewable electricity was essentially slim to non-existent. So this is around about the time where also there starts to be growing concern in European energy policy world about the geopolitics of energy supply. You can see from the dates here, we're starting to deal with the first inklings of when the Russian-Ukrainian gas disputes were starting to kick in. And that certainly became intensified as the process for negotiating this legislation got moving. So you see here a new reason to care about renewables and targets for achieving them starting to rear its head, which is this is about not only cleaner, less emitting energy supply, it's also about indigenous supply that doesn't have to rely upon insecure transit routes or potentially unreliable trading partners, something which became hugely important as this process and other legislation after this went on. So one of the really interesting things in the shift that you see that this actually precipitates is that relatively quickly the member states at the level of the European Council were willing to agree, only 3 or 4 months after the Commission proposal, that there was a need to shift from indicative targets at the national level actually to having a binding EU-level target of more or less 20% of renewables by 2020. It fluctuated a bit because of new member states coming in during the process, so it was originally about 21.3, and then it came down to around about 20. But that also binding national targets would be an appropriate way of ensuring that progress was actually to be made. And if you read all the documentation, you see the European Parliament's very excited about this. It lauds this as a great step forward. It's imposing more obligations on member states to do the right thing, which they promised they'd do previously but didn't bother to, and now they will actually pursue. Now, that said, of course, as the European Parliament always does, for those of you who ever read the process, it also had a number of other things it thought would have made it better, not just the binding targets, not just the increased range of obligations. The European Parliament wanted all kinds of other things attached, including various aspects of penalties for failing to meet targets and also penalties for failing to follow trajectories to reach targets and so on. Unsurprisingly, the member states were not terribly excited by those proposals. And eventually what you end up with is a proposal for a directive from the Commission, which had a number of key elements. I think one to bear in mind, first of all, is an understanding that, as I said at the beginning, different countries have different natural resource potentials and also different financial resources available to them to pursue these goals. And it was clearly understood that there's a danger of setting binding European and national targets if one doesn't take into account those differences at the domestic level. Subsidiarity consideration par excellence, right? And so the idea was to create a European umbrella target, 20%, more or less, under which then different member states, based upon where they had already got to, definitional question, if you include hydroelectricity, Austria was already about 70, 75% renewable. So actually, you couldn't really just tell the Austrians, oh, 20, it would be fine, because they would go, right, well, we're sorted. What's the problem? So you take the ability they already have in their system, you also take into account their potentials, natural resource-wise, to enhance, and you try to take into account, as best you can, a degree of GDP-related assessment. And you come up with, if you look at the table in the legislation, quite a differentiated series of targets for the different member states to achieve. Now, behind that, there is then some logic that if you have a country that can create surplus renewables far beyond, then putting our free trade hat on for a minute, the logical thing to do would be allow them to take advantage of that surplus if it would be cheaper for country B to buy from country A rather than generating for itself, right? That would be a logical free trade answer to the question, how do we at least cost with best social and environmental welfare achieve renewables goals? The original proposal contained an idea that you could choose which national system you sold your green certificate to, right? That got blocked by a combination of people. Some people in the parliament thought that it would be too uncertain, they would be bringing in all kinds of free trade issues and it would undermine national policies. Some people at the level of member states, Germany and Poland and then the UK, were worried that it would prevent them from designing tailored and appropriate national schemes to try to achieve renewable goals. So what we instead ended up with is a scheme of what they call statistical transfer, which sounds deeply unexciting and probably is. The idea being that if you have a surplus in Member State A of documents that prove that more renewables than you needed under your national target were generated in your territory, you as a government, before you cancel them, could say, well, before we cancel them to prove we've done it, we could sell them to the Brits, who, let's face it, haven't done brilliantly in advancing their renewables targets, or indeed other countries where they don't have much in the way of renewables potentials. So this is a state-to-state transfer system, and it's not done for favours, it's done for money. It's cold, hard cash that selling takes place, right? It might be done for favours too, but I'm not privy to that information, and so I can't comment on it. So that's the sort of structure that ended up leading to member states accepting that they would indeed be bound by these targets at national level too. So what I'm now going to do is try and talk to you a little bit about some of the measures that perhaps help us to give teeth to how these binding targets might be monitored and enforced in practice. So, you see in Article 3.2 there, it says, Member States are obliged. They shall introduce measures effectively designed to ensure that the share of energy equals or exceeds the indicative trajectory. So note the trajectory is indicative, the final target is binding, another little interesting thing, set out for that member state. Now what you then find within the details of the directive is a variety of provisions which set up articles 13, 14, 15, 16 and so on, procedural and institutional and other obligations on member states to try to facilitate achieving these targets. So things like, for example, guaranteeing priority access to a grid for renewably generated electricity. Because the real danger with this stuff is, well, what do we know about it? It can be intermittent, because you can't guarantee that the wind will blow all the time. The sun certainly won't shine all the time. But also, that puts potential stresses on the infrastructure through which all of this is supplied. Because there will be times when, imagine you're talking about the north of Germany, next to the North Sea, where it's very windy, and you have a really windy day, and basically all the energy needs for northern Germany and half of middle Germany are all supplied at any given point in time by the wind blowing, because of all the windmills they have, right? And so in that situation, that puts potentially enormous stresses on the grid that transmits this stuff. And if you could simply say, this is too difficult, I'm going to not let your renewable energy have access to the grid, then actually you won't be properly setting up your system to receive such that the sort of stuff you're trying to encourage will actually be what you generate and what you consume. It's a really important practical point about the network-bound aspects of electricity in particular. So obligations get put in place to try to make this actually work in practice, to enhance the ability to do so. There are other details, like, for example, do you make a new renewable energy generator pay the full price for strengthening the grid where it connects? If you do, you're giving benefits to everyone else by making the grid better, right? So you're charging someone to benefit other people as well as themselves. So a lot of this is directed to try to ensure that the new capacity that gets put onto the grid doesn't get penalized simply for being new and creating different problems. So lots of this stuff is directed at dealing with that. Also, what I told you previously about the national plans under the 2001 directive is definitely beefed up here. So they have to have this horrible acronym, but I can't think of a better way of describing it. National Renewable Energy Action Plan, or NREAP. And for that plan, member states have to do all kinds of things. They have to explain how they propose to achieve indicative targets along a trajectory, which are more or less mildly exponential in their increase. They're not completely linear. There's a good reason for that. But it's unlikely that you will immediately get deployment in a nice, simple, one after the other linear way. So allowing for that is a good idea. But also they have to tell you things like where they expect that to come from. So the UK has to say, we expect to have X percent from wind energy, from solar energy, and so on. Or we expect to buy some from the Germans in the form of statistical transfer. Or we want to do a joint project with the Irish where we all together put loads of windmills somewhere and then we use that to meet our obligations. So quite detailed level of planning required by the member states, trying to predict how they will meet their indicative trajectory to lead to the final target that each member state has been given. So you start to see here that there are some things in the legislation that might actually give certain teeth for the Commission. Certain things to bite on that are clear enough, that are precise enough, that you can point at and say, you haven't done that. You haven't properly organized your plan. You haven't put something together with evidence that suggests that what you intend to do is actually feasible and practical. So you start to see some elements here. And these could also, all it seems to me, be very relevant not only for European level enforcement and compliance, but also for the national level, in the sense that the national scheme that sets up this plan may put obligations on the regulator, for example, to see how different companies, in the form of the grid company, the generating company, or indeed the supply and retail companies, are actually fulfilling these various obligations that are imposed at the national level to achieve these sorts of goals. And that means that if the regulator isn't doing its job properly, then other private parties might be able to complain about it in that kind of way. So these details and the obligations and roles that they impose at the national and the European level seem to me to start to enhance, to a degree, the ability to try to get member states and actors within member states to do what's required to enhance renewables. So then there are various details that I'd just like to pull out of that just a little bit more. They're obliged to adopt effectively designed measures. No definition of that, and in a sense, again, on the one hand, you'd like there to be one. On the other hand, it's kind of obvious that there isn't a definition of that, because the idea of this is that it's supposed to be able to evolve technologically as these different sorts of things develop over time. You know, you wouldn't have, for example, said 20-odd years ago that solar would have made any sense much at all in the UK when the cost of the actual installation and the equipment was so high, and also its efficiency was so low, and its lifetime was so short. All of these things have improved. So how effectively designed your measure is, you have to take into account a degree of, as it were, learning, a degree of, for want of a better word, reflexivity in responding to what evolution you see out there in the market and out there in the R&D world to understand what might be feasible going forward. So one thing that I wondered about is whether or not we might be able to learn a little bit from the evolution of what is treated as effectively designed from other parts of European law. In the sense that if you were to look at the old Integrated Pollution Prevention and Control Directive that now you find embodied in the Industrial Emissions Directive, you see a discussion there about best available techniques. And then you see various reference figures developed from those best available techniques. And if you start to look at the way in which they are actually enforced and that the Commission pursues them, develops them, is involved in their comitology-based development and application, you start to see certain objective criteria emerging. They're not simply going to be discussed by a committee and decided on an ad hoc ongoing basis. You start to see things where objectively you will look at certain elements that you would need to include for something to be best available. Or, in the renewables terminology, effectively designed, having thought of these various sorts of aspects. So we might be able to learn from that area. We might also be able to learn from the Wild Birds Directive, again, where you see similar sorts of questions arise with regard to whether or not the designation and the measures taken to protect those sorts of habitats and species are actually done in an objectively justifiable way. So there's maybe something we can learn from that, that while now it's not crystal clear what that means, maybe in a few years, for one reason or another, we will learn better about what measures count as effectively designed and what we can discount as being not effectively designed at all. One side note, one other place we might go to think about this question for the competition state aid lawyers amongst you is, of course, this is not the only place where Europe deals with renewable energy. Right? I've already mentioned trade, you know, free movement law to you, Preußen Elektra, some recent cases too on that. If anyone's doing EU trade, then you'll have seen them, or you will see them. But also, the DG competition is fascinated by national support mechanisms for renewables because it worries that they will distort competitive processes at the national level. And an interesting thing that you will find if you look at last year's various publications by the Commission include a block exemption regulation on state aid, and it includes an energy and environmental aid guidelines, which have a whole section which discusses operating aid for renewable electricity generation above and below certain financial thresholds. Below thresholds, regulation, block exemption, above thresholds, ongoing guidelines, individual decision. Okay? And if you were going to go and read them, which I spent far more of my life in the last 2 years doing than I would care to admit, you would find that there is a competition economic-based series of measures that the DG Comp, and it really is DG Comp who did this, I guarantee it wasn't DG Energy, certainly wasn't DG Environment if you read them, which they think are effective design for support schemes, right? And that's not something which, if you just read this directive as an environmental lawyer, would even remotely occur to you. But if you're a European lawyer generalist, then it starts to become clear that we can learn a lot of different things from a lot of different places about effective design, and one of them turns out to be competition law. I should say that I don't agree with the Commission about what it thinks is effective in those particular guidelines and block exemption regulations, and I'm in print saying so. And I talked to the guy who drafted them, and we had a very fun fight over dinner about it, and we left friends, which was good. But suffice to say, it was very, very interesting to see that this was developed not by the bit of the Commission that will receive the reports from this directive. This is DG Competition that's dealing with individual case-by-case assessment of national support schemes designed to meet binding targets. So there are other places to go for enforcement that aren't simply about targets, but nevertheless might help us in one way or another to achieve them. What I fear is that the state aid guidelines will do the opposite. That actually, because they're sufficiently stringent, it's very hard for member states in certain ways to get clearance for some of their planned support schemes, it may do the opposite. They may be effectively designed for maintaining competition, but not for achieving the environmental goals and targets that the Renewables Directive obliges member states to do. So there is a joined up thinking deficit here for me. I've mentioned the Renewable Energy Action Plan, so I won't repeat that. The indicative trajectory is also just worth bearing in mind for a second, in the sense that the Parliament would have attached the ability to do various aspects of trade between member states to the idea that member states should be on track, should be near the indicative trajectory. And this would certainly give more teeth to the Commission to try to enforce in what I would describe as a timely fashion. However, the trajectory is indicative, and all it really triggers is that the member state has to explain why it's fallen short of the trajectory, and the Commission might be able to make suggestions but cannot enforce or make member states do things differently, despite all at the bottom there, the reporting and monitoring obligations. So, briefly, missed opportunities. Well, you can tell from what I've said that certainly the Parliament thought this was a miss, failing to include a penalty mechanism for target achievement. And the Parliament even would have said for indicative trajectory target achievement too, in the sense that this gets you away from what you need to be doing. The further away you get from your trajectory, the harder it is finally to meet your target. The way to get back on course is to have some kind of incentive, perhaps in the form of a rather iron fist at the end to say, no, you've got to get on with it, you've got to do things better. The other thing is portfolios of technologies, and this is a little energy involved, but if you think about it, there is one aspect of this legislation which does focus on a particular technology, and that's biofuels. That's a whole separate section of the directive. Otherwise, the directive says nothing to you about you should enhance wind power or solar power. It's simply renewable energy, full stop. You work out for yourself how to do that. And for those of you who've had a look at the post-Lisbon competence issue under energy, you'll see that that chimes very nicely with Article 194 of the treaty, which says member states have a right to choose their own energy mix. There's a lot more said about portfolios, but there isn't time today. So we now are in a phase where the Commission and the Member States have been talking a lot about what they will do next, legislatively, in the renewables field. For some people, there are ambitious new targets that are likely to be proposed soon. For other people, they're ambitious, but they're by no means ambitious enough. So there's a level question there, first of all. What level should we be trying to pursue? Some say that if we want to meet our climate obligations and we want to enhance our indigenous supply security, then we desperately need to do more of this sooner, for then it will cost us less when we have to do it later. It's another point about timeliness. Member states, in the interim, have decided that their concession 8 or 9 years ago was a really stupid thing to do, and they are desperately keen not to have binding targets anymore. Instead, they want an EU binding target, and they want to go back to national indicative targets. With a few exceptions. The Irish are scared witless that we will no longer have binding targets because what the Irish want to do is sell the surplus to the UK, whom they accurately calculate will probably not get stuff done in time and will need to give them lots of money to meet their targets. Okay, that's a cynical view. I'm a Brit, so I can say that. What I really mean is, again, go back to the trading idea, it would be comparatively more efficient if the Irish have better wind resources and we have cross-border transmission capacity for them to fulfill some of our obligations if we pay them for it. Because will that be any worse than us imposing obligations which ultimately you and I, as customers, pay for at the end of the day? Answer, if it's more efficient and more effective, it will actually cost us less at the end of the day in Britain to do that than to try to do it all by ourselves. And I've already mentioned 1942. The reason I just want to mention it here again, I also spent a lot of my last 2 or 3 years of my life thinking about what the hell Article 1942, second paragraph, means. If anyone's had the misfortune to try to read it and understand what it means, I sympathize and I empathize. The reason here that I think it's potentially interesting is because it's formulated in such a way that measures taken in the energy field by the EU, which if you read paragraph one, include renewables, include internal market, include competition, include solidarity, include efficiency, all relevant to our discussion today. Paragraph two, second sentence says, these measures shall not affect a member state's right to do various things, including make choices as to the sources of its energy supply and the structure of its energy industry. Now, if that really means what it baldly seems to say, it's very hard to imagine you could ever adopt a third renewables directive. Because how can you have a directive that has any kind of targets and details that won't affect member states' quote-unquote right in this way? There's a paper I wrote about that, which I could have talked about today as well, which says that I don't believe that's what it really means. If you're interested, I can send you a copy. Your lawyers, so I don't need to go through this in any detail at all. I provide this here simply to round out the picture of what this then means for enforcement. In the sense that you've got 258 enforcement proceedings, informal, and I've already mentioned formal stages, which might ultimately lead to a Court of Justice ruling saying, member state, you failed, and could lead to a Court of Justice ruling saying, member state, pay penalty, and also pay for the period when you were in breach. That's a possibility. This process is largely still rather diplomatic in nature, negotiated between the member state and the commission bringing the case. Often the most effective thing seems to have been what I might describe as naming and shaming. In the sense of publish a press release saying, you're doing pretty badly, here are the recalcitrant member states and the horrible things they aren't doing. And that often is enough to get member states to get back on track. But the crucial two things I just wanted to emphasize here, 4 years, more or less, average, it takes one of these cases to get to a decision by a court that says, yes, member state didn't do what it was supposed to do. That is not timely in its enforcement capability to try to achieve targets that are set over a specified period of time. Because you're going to have to foresee way in advance to have any impact at all upon how things will be achieved going forward. And also, will it ever really effectively achieve the outcome? So imagine, what are you going to get? You're going to get a judgment at the end of 4 years or so that says, member state was wrong, should have done more. Might even say, member state, pay for the time you're in breach. That'll be tough here, because there aren't many hard-edged obligations, as I've been explaining. But okay, pay some kind of penalty in future until you make good. Well, that'll be hard, because making good is a complicated combination of investment and planning and all the rest of it. But also, more importantly, where do they get the money from to pay these penalties? That you would kind of hope they would spend on renewable stuff, and instead they're paying them someone else. So there's all kinds of effectiveness in terms of outcome securing here that I just don't see this procedure achieving very well. And everything that applies to that is worse if we use 259, another member state. So I will simply skate over that and say people refer me to it sometimes and I smile broadly and say, but it won't do anything. Likelier is political pressure to be brought by other member states in decision-making processes on those member states who aren't doing enough. And not as part of a renewables negotiation or even an energy or environment negotiation, but in the political horse trading way that we know always happens, which is, well, okay, look, you get on with that and I'll stop yelling you about that if you agree with me to do something about immigration. Again, you can't prove that it happens, but everyone knows that it does. A national level, likewise, do you want me to stop, Marcus? Am I going on too long?
Really briefly.
The national level, I've really already mentioned that. I think that the practical problem we have here, enforcement-wise, is these obligations I've described to you, they don't really grant rights to private parties. You know, you're the fortunate beneficiary of whatever the state decides to do to encourage you to do something, right? So the sort of thing you've seen in Preussen Elektra, the state says, we're going to give you a premium above the market price so that you generate renewables for us, and that will incentivize you to put loads of windmills up in Germany. Fly over northern Germany, you'll see it work brilliantly, right? Fly over southern Germany, it worked quite well there too, which is kind of weird because there's not much wind there, but never mind. But the point is you haven't got a right to receive it, right? You're simply fortunate if someone adopts it and then you can rely upon it. So the private party enforcement that in other areas of EU law for us is just absolutely crucial and is really, really far-reaching, here gets you next to nowhere, except that if states do nothing, then your public law judicial review scenario might say, well, okay, you should have considered this, you should have taken more effective measures to achieve that. You see that in certain cases in the UK where certain aspects of renewables weren't taken into account in adopting measures. You also see a little bit of that in the Dutch Urgenda case to do with the emissions trading regime and whether the obligation to reduce emissions means that they should have done more. So what does that leave me to conclude in terms of enforcement? A lot of monitoring and reporting, publicity-related enforcement, but not a lot of hard-edged enforcement unless we change what the rules actually say. So there's an anodyne conclusion, point one. It's going to be hard. It's going to be really hard to enforce this kind of thing against member states, right? If you're going to secure that binding nature of those sorts of targets, then a lot of actors are going to be involved, a lot of different aspects will be involved in trying to make people live up to the things they've said they'd do or they should do. What do I expect for the future? And I expect, frankly, that member states who don't want binding targets will win, and so we'll end up with an EU binding target, we'll end up with national indicative targets, and the place that we will see most activity in the next 4 or 5 years on this is member states fighting with DG competition about how to design national support schemes, and member states fighting on international trade and investment law grounds, particularly investment, when they changed their renewables policies and people who relied upon them thought they lost out. But investment laws are subject for another day for someone who knows much more about it than me. Sorry for going on too long. Thank you very much.